Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. In this episode, I'm in conversation with the head of one of the U.S.'s leading science centers. We talk about the physics of baseball, ice hockey, and soccer, the importance of science literacy, and about next week's solar eclipse that will sweep across parts of Mexico, the U.S., and Canada. COSI, the Center of Science and Industry, is a science museum and research center that's operated in Columbus, Ohio for 60 years. In 2016, the immunologist and science educator Frederick Bertley became COSI's president and CEO. This followed an 8-year stint at the Center for Innovation in Science Learning at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. As well as running COSI, Frederick is very active on social media, promoting and explaining science to a wide audience. He joins me down the line from Columbus. Hi, Frederick. Welcome to the podcast.
How you doing, Dr. J? Thank you for having me on Physics World's podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And shall I call you Dr. B? Because I think that's what you go by, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah. They've given me that tagline and now it's stuck. So Dr. B to Dr. J, we'll have a great conversation.
Okay. So the first thing we're going to talk about, and it is, I mean, people are getting very excited about this in North America and particularly in Columbus, is the total solar eclipse. And that's going to happen on the 8th of April. Can you give us a flavor of what COSI is doing for this very exciting event?
Yeah, we're really lucky here in Columbus, Ohio, as you know, center of the country here in the U.S. And it's actually, we specifically as a city are in the 99.4% totality space. So as you know, this eclipse is coming down from Mexico, rising up through Texas, across the Midwest, and then up through Northeast into Canada. But for us, we're at 99.4% totality. So we are super excited. And for COSI specifically, we are actually building off of the success we had in 2017 at that other total solar eclipse. And so we did a great job engaging the community. But now we've leveled up. What does that mean? First of all, in our building, we're going to be broadcasting live by our local ABC channel right here from our great museum and science center for all people to hear all things eclipse, building up to that seminal moment of 4 minutes and change of hopefully complete darkness. But we're also partnering with the community. So for example, Columbus has a series of libraries called the Columbus Metropolitan Library with 23 branches. So our educators and scientists are going to each of the 23 branches and doing everything from solar activations, hands-on interactive science, technology, engineering, and math activities for the public, kiddos, and adults alike, obviously supplying solar glasses as well, eclipse glasses. And so that's one way we're connected with the community. But we're not just working in educational spaces or libraries. We're also in bars, which is one of my favorite themes. So there's a popular company here in Columbus called Land Grant. And so we will be there. They expect over 2,500 adults partying, being excited all around this eclipse. We're also working with Metro Parks. Again, in the Central Ohio area, we have these things called Metro Parks. And so we'll be there. These are massive areas, tons of acres, setting up all kinds of activation and viewing sites. And then finally, where there's going to be an area of totality is 2 hours north from Columbus in the great city of Cleveland. We're partnering with the Cleveland Great Lakes Science Center, which is a science museum like ours. We're also partnering with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and with NASA, and we're going to have a prominent presence there for the Cleveland and greater Cleveland community. So we're doing all kinds of things related to getting the public really excited about this natural phenomena that really expresses the beauty of nature and science.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I am a bit jealous. I've never actually seen a total eclipse. I've seen a few partial ones, and they were exciting. But yeah, to see a total eclipse, that's going to be amazing. Are you, you know, when you're engaging with people, are you talking about the physics of the eclipse, and you know, maybe a bit of solar physics if it's a clear day, which I hope it is. People will be able to see parts of the sun that, you know, normally you just can't see? Are you getting into those details?
Absolutely. And before I get to that, just so you know, I think you're based in Toronto, if I'm not mistaken. There's a direct flight from Toronto right here to Columbus, so we can get you here in an hour if you want to experience
that. Well, actually, it was funny you should say that. I'm in the UK. And,
you're in the UK?
Yeah, okay. But the far, any listeners that happen to be in Toronto, Toronto itself will not be in the region of totality, but southwest of the city, so Burlington, where I grew up, is just on the edge, and Niagara Falls as well will catch some of it, and the north shore of Lake Erie as well will catch it. So I suggest that, well, I one of my worries is that millions of people will pour out of Toronto towards southwestern Ontario.
You're right. It will
clog up the highways. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, there is a small part of southwestern Ontario that will capture it. And so if you're lucky enough to be in Hamilton or St. Catharines, yeah, definitely. Definitely do it. Unfortunately, I'll be in Bristol.
You got it. I forgot that you relocated. Yeah. So, so with that, to your question about what we talk about, absolutely. I mean, one, we want to make sure people enjoy and appreciate that this is a natural phenomenon, but we definitely get into the science. So first of all, just explaining what eclipses are, you know, differentiating lunar eclipses to solar eclipses, then differentiating the kinds of solar eclipses that exist. You know, it's not just a total solar eclipse, just partial. There's about four different kinds. But also getting people to understand that this excitement about once in 100 years or once in 300 years, actually, solar eclipses, and you know this, solar eclipses happen anywhere from 2 to 5 times a year, with a total solar eclipse happening about every 18 months or so. It's just the probability of that area of shading, that shadow hitting the Earth in your geolocation, that's about once every 300 years. So as a scientific phenomenon, they happen way more often. But for you to see it in your lifetime, wherever you are, that may be once in 100 to 300 years. But then we also talk about, what do you see? This idea of occluding the sun, allowing you to see the beautiful corona, that atmosphere, if you will, around the sun, that we're used to seeing the atmosphere around the Earth, but we don't think of an atmosphere around the sun. Well, there is one there, and it's called a corona, and that's that beautiful ring you see. So talking about that, but really getting into all the different things that the solar eclipse allows you to appreciate, not just of the sun, but of the neighboring stars, of understanding Einstein's special and general theory of relativity was actually proved by understanding how solar eclipses work. So we do get into the science, but again, it's a combination of getting the public to be excited about science, learn some little scientific stuff, but really be engaged and be excited about the wonderful, amazing universe around us.
Well, that's great, Dr. B. And, you know, as I said, I really hope it goes well for you and you get a beautiful sunny spring day in Ohio. And it is spring in North America, and that means baseball. I think Major League Baseball is going to start very shortly. And you've done some work about, you know, talking about the physics of baseball and how understanding this physics can make us better players. Can you talk a bit about that? What is the physics of baseball?
Yeah. And considering you're in Bristol, so we'll talk both about baseball and cricket. But really, just understanding that in general, sports are an amazing ecosystem for understanding science and engineering. Now, getting more myopic, looking at baseball, I mean, that is a physicist's dream, right? You're using force is equal to mass times acceleration in almost every component about it. The pitcher has to throw this spherical object to you, and they're not throwing it to you at 10 miles an hour. It's anywhere from 85 to 95, sometimes 100 miles per hour. So just the physics of that trajectory, how that ball is spinning, is just incredible. So understanding how as a pitcher you hold the ball, how you twist your fingers to impact that rotation, because that rotation at that acceleration can cause the ball to curve. And the more you understand that and you understand airflow, resistance, and how much spin or juju, as baseball pitchers like to say, you put on that ball, can really impact if it's going to be a straight fastball, if it's going to be a curveball, if it's going to be a sinker, etc. And then for the batter, understanding the physics of again, force is equal to mass times acceleration. You have this bat, you have to swing it. You want to accelerate. You don't just want to swing at a constant velocity, but you want to accelerate from your stance position of just holding that bat to swinging it, accelerating as fast as possible all the way through over the plate. And then you want to hope you connect the ball at the right surface area of the ball hitting the bat in such a way that it doesn't go too high, it doesn't go too low, but that the trajectory, which is typically a parabola, whether you're shooting a jump shot for a basketball or hitting a baseball, it follows a parabolic trajectory. But depending on the angle of impact, you'll get it over the wall as a home run, you'll get it as a ground base, you know, out at single, or pop fly that'll be caught in the outfield. So the more you can understand that, the better you can set yourself up as an athlete. But I do want to caution, it's one thing to appreciate the physics of baseball, even as a pitcher or batter, but there's also that natural innate that some people have this kind of capacity, hand-eye coordination, and all these other things that allow them to be even that much better than someone else who might have the same level of understanding of science of the sport.
And I think, you know, to me, the most interesting of all sort of physics-related phenomenon in baseball is the knuckleball, which is, I think it's sort of the opposite of a curveball, isn't it? In the sense that you're trying to impart no spin on the ball, and it can do some really strange things. And I think in that situation, it really is the intuition of the pitcher, isn't it, who knows how to throw a knuckleball. Because it can go horribly wrong, can't it?
A knuckleball. Absolutely. That is such a complicated pitch. And I mean, imagine throwing something at, you know, knuckleballs usually, you know, anywhere from 70 to 80 miles an hour. Imagine throwing something that fast without it rotating. And it's a spherical object, and it doesn't rotate. And so now it depends on the elements, literally the differential of the air above the ball, below the ball, which we can't see with our eyes and pick it up. But if the ball is not spinning, the only forces on it are literally the air on top and below, and that can make the ball do some funny things. So yeah, it's a very tough pitch, but it's all about science for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have to say, you know, we've written a bit about baseball, and the thing that I found the most interesting was definitely the knuckleball. And it's not only baseball that you're interested in. You're a Canadian. You're from Montreal originally. So there's a special place for ice hockey in your heart. And you've also looked at soccer as well. So can you talk a bit about the physics of hockey and soccer, and why we should be interested in it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and you called it out. I'm born and raised in Montreal, Canada. So true story, my goal in life, Dr. J, was to either be a fireman or play for the National Hockey League and my Montreal Canadiens. I was really into hockey. And even though as a kid, I didn't really understand the science of sports, as an adult, I really grew to appreciate it. And so if you think about hockey, right, one of the best shots in hockey is called the slap shot, right? And so you're going to hit the puck as hard as possible into the net. But what's really happening is it's a classic physics kind of leverage. You know, you got this stick, which is an extension of your arm, dramatic extension of the arm, and then it's going to hit this puck, but the stick isn't super rigid. It's got some tensile properties, but it will also flex. So understanding the force and how much the stick is flexing, and make sure you're transferring all the energy from your body, your hips, your waist, into your arm, through the stick, into the puck, will make that be one of the fastest projectiles in sports. And so if you understand that, how you, as an athlete, how you position your stick, how you position your arm, and exactly where you impact that puck can make it go X speed, X plus Y speed, or Z speed, and everything in between. And so that's, again, from the athletic kind of perspective of appreciating the sport, an example of hockey. But the reason why we do that here at COSI, to really get into the science of hockey and even the science of soccer, I mean, we talk about how do you make those incredible Bendham, like Beckham curved soccer kicks, right? And that's all physics as well. But the reason why we get into that is we're so passionate about getting the wider world to love and feel comfortable about science. And yes, you can go into the hallowed halls of Oxford, Cambridge, McGill, University of Toronto, and try to learn the science. Or you can try to find a way to connect to people in a broader way. And people love a bunch of things. They love music, they love food, But sports is an almost universal language. So if we can get people who generally are super excited about sports, but bring out something scientific and get them engaged around that, that's a great way of connecting them to that and increasing what we hope is a passion for science literacy.
And I mean, on your hockey videos, you know, you can see that there you are skating around with your stick. So you know, it's no exaggeration that you're a hockey player. When you're out on the ice, I mean, do you think about the physics, or are you back, you know, with the, you know, the pitcher who might understand a bit of the physics, but it really is an intuitive process when you're doing a slap shot, or you're going back around the nets, you know, lots of physics there. But do you think about it? Do you find it useful to think about it?
I mean, that's such a great question. And I would love to poll 1,000 scientists who also are, or 1,000 physicists who also are athletes, to see how much they think about that. Again, I grew up as a sporty kid, so I played soccer, basketball, hockey was my passion. So I did that as a kid growing up into adulthood. So as a kid, I was not thinking about, you know, the science of it. But becoming an adult and having an appreciation and, you know, an understanding of some scientific fields, everything from physics, by the way, to physiology and neuroscience, because that plays a role in sports too, how your brain's wired, how you're firing. So I definitely think about it. There's no question. How much do I actually apply it in that super fast instant? That's a crapshoot to say. You know, definitely I think about, okay, if the person, if the hockey player, for example, is coming around the net from the other side, you know, you understand a little bit of momentum. You understand that, okay, they got to slow up and pivot the other way. But it's almost like it's such a fast sport that even your kind of cognitive understanding of it kind of trails a little bit behind how reactionary the darn sport is, you know? It's like you are literally on the edge. And so understanding it definitely allows you to be just a little kind of better in terms of doing some basic things better. But the actual super excitement, that cutting edge of athleticism, that cutting edge of skill and technique, I can't say it's like a clinical class of, I understand the physics behind this and that's going to get me to get a goal right now. It's much more nuanced than that. But I would love to take a poll.
Yeah, I mean, that is interesting. You know, you talked about the cognitive factors. And of course, you know, Wayne Gretzky, who, you know, I suppose the best hockey player ever, was famous for, he was able to, you know, he knew exactly where the puck was going before it even went there. And, you know, I suppose that suggests to me that his number one skill as an athlete was his spatial awareness, his ability to process information, to understand what other players are going to do. I suppose that's not physics, but, you know, there must be a lot of science in that as well.
I'm so glad you said that, because it may not be physics, but it absolutely is science. Everything from psychology to neuroscience. And back to your baseball, you know, we are getting into spring. You know, think about this. The pitcher throws the pitch. That batter has to swing like literally at the time that ball is releasing from that pitcher's hand. I mean, that batter is not swinging when that ball is halfway to them, let alone at the plate. And so kind of like Wayne Gretzky, the GOAT of hockey, understanding where the puck is going before it's there, where an athlete might be skating to, that batter had to study the pitcher, has to study all the pitches that pitcher's been doing for the last however many pitches, understand where they throw, how they throw, then also study the anatomy and physiology of the body, because we all have tells. It's kind of like gambling or playing cards. You have a tell. So a pitcher might do a little thing and you're like, okay, that means he or she's going to throw a curveball, or they might do something else. So there's a lot of psychology and neuroscience that comes in to being a cutting edge athlete as well, in that anticipatory piece you were talking about, a la Gretzky. So absolutely.
So, Dr. B, you've also created the Color of Science Initiative, which invites the public to engage with remarkable women and persons of color in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Can you talk a bit about this initiative?
Yeah, Dr. J, I'm really glad you asked me about that. There's two real points to the Color of Science program, and it stems from the concept that, hey, world, all scientists aren't old men with thick glasses and pocket protectors. Women make fantastic scientists and engineers, and so do persons of color. So that's kind of the overarching construct. And so What it really leverages, though, is there are 8 billion people on this beautiful planet. For us at COSI, we know, and this is one of our taglines, genius or invention knows no color, no race, no gender, no religion. In other words, it's kind of a Gaussian or normal distribution to those who are wired to be athletes, those who are wired to have songbird voices and sing, those who are wired to do PhD in physics like yourself, right? And so there is that just generic spread that's out there. So if we as a world, or in the UK, or in my case, in the US, if we don't leverage providing opportunities to everybody, and again, I'm not trying to make everybody, color science or programs like this aren't trying to make everybody a PhD scientist, but you want to expose every a wide of a denominator as possible of people to the wonders of science, technology, engineering, and math, because you might spark that next Marie Curie, Albert Einstein, you know, whoever your heroes are, Benjamin Banneker in the scientific space. And so you want to make sure you maximize that. That's just beneficial to the planet. That's just beneficial to any country, right? Because you might find that person that might cure breast cancer. You might find that person that might figure out AI. You might find that person. And so making sure everybody has the opportunity to have this experience is really critical. And the second piece is to showcase to the world that when you think of scientists, and you know this as a PhD scientist, if you ask 100 people in the UK, if I ask 100 people here in the US, you know, regular people outside there from the public, close your eyes, think of a scientist, who do they think about? Albert Einstein. If you say, okay, please tell me a female scientist, who do they say? Marie Curie. And if it's Black History Month and you say, give me a scientist, they'll say there's this peanut guy. I think his name is George Washington Carver. Like, that is all you get. And then if you ask people, okay, hey, that's great. They're amazing people, but they're all dead. Can you name me a living scientist? Then they scratch their head. They say there's this guy in a wheelchair. He's a physicist. I think his name is Stephen Hawking. They're like, no, wait. He actually passed away. You know, great scientist, but he's a great physicist, but he passed away. And then they scratch their head some more and then say, oh, there's Neil deGrasse Tyson. And then there's this Bill Nye, the science guy. Like, think about that, Dr. J. That is, you know, I mean, I don't know who they'll name in the UK. Maybe they'll come up with, you know, Mr. Penicillin. You know, I don't know, Fleming, but it's unbelievable that almost anybody can name all kinds of actors, actresses, singers, dancers, athletes. And let me be clear, I'm a fan of sports and I'm a fan of entertainment. So I'm not poo-pooing that genre or those professions. But we can rattle those people off. Yet scientists and engineers make our world go round, provide our medicines for our loved ones, allow us to communicate through satellite and cell phones, allow us to have material science and engineers to make our clothes stain resistant, to make our roads and bridges safe. We cannot survive, unless you're completely off the grid in the cave or something, we as humanity cannot survive without scientists and engineers doing the work, yet the average public can't name 3 to 5 living scientists. So that's the other purpose of the color of science. So fundamentally, one, make sure as many kiddos get exposed to this stuff, because if he or she or they want to grow up and be a scientist engineer, hey, they had a chance at it. It wasn't because they were from a poor community or a disenfranchised community. And then for us as the public, hey, yes, celebrate athletes. That's great. Celebrate entertainers. But if someone came up with a breast cancer drug, they need to be held to the highest level of celebration as well. So that's the purpose of the color science, showing the beauty in the landscape of people who are out there. And yes, they're diverse populations that are working on these amazing fields.
And that actually, that brings me very nicely to my final question, which I suppose is about, you know, your mission at COSI. You spoke passionately about scientific literacy for people. How, you know, if somebody comes to COSI regularly, let's say they're a big fan, they come with their family, what would you like them to take away that makes them more scientifically literate?
Yeah, that's a good question. And being scientifically literate, you know, it's not going to happen by walking and doing 1 3-hour visit at a science museum, you know, but the goal on site in our physical building, the science museum, but also the goal through our programmatic initiatives that we do in schools, in community centers, in churches, in synagogues. We like to say where people live, learn, and lounge outside the building. Both of those kinds of programs are to get people to, and I can speak a lot about the US, there is this almost apathy to the fact that people are science illiterate. You know, like, think about this. If you can't read or write, you know, and you're linguistically illiterate, there's like, you're embarrassed. your family and friends are embarrassed with you. If you can't count, if you go to a store and buy something, you can't count the change, you're enumerate, you know, there's some shame there. But in the US and much of the world, I mean, I won't speak for the UK, but in the US and much of the world, there's almost like, nah, I don't know science. I'm not a nerd. I'm a geek. I'm not a geek. And there's no shame to it. And that's not great because the consequences can be real. Think subprime crisis that shut down the whole world. People didn't understand basic interest rate, basic expense, right? Just basic math. And so what we want to do through this science literacy is show people in our building or through our programs that little aspects, whether it's studying the eclipse, whether it's seeing a really cool mechanical engineering thing within our building, what have you, gets you more comfortable when you start thinking, hey, wait a minute, I understood that. That was kind of neat. Maybe I'll Google it a little more and read up a little more, and then maybe I'll go on this journey to be more comfortable wanting to read and thereby becoming more literate around science. It's not that everybody should have a PhD in physics like yourself, Dr. J. It'd be great. The world probably would be better, but that's not the goal.
I'd question that, but I'll take
leave
your
that
word
to
for
you
it.
And your colleagues to question. But the goal is really just to have people be more comfortable about wanting to know about, again, the wonders of the natural universe, the wonders of science. And frankly, you know, if we talk about the 21st century, going back to some other point we just said, is society is also absolutely dependent on science and technology. So, you know, whether it's practical purpose, you just want to have a better job, there's a lot of jobs that you can get with a two-year college degree that you can start in the U.S. at $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 and elevate your family out of a tough situation if you're in a tough situation. So there's also these practical applications about science and engineering and technology. Not only is it not going away, but Moore's Law, things are increasing and changing every 18 months. It's really here to stay. The more we embrace it as a comprehensive society, the better off we'll be.
Well, that's great. Yeah, that's very inspiring. And hopefully, and I'm sure it'll happen when the eclipse comes, you'll be inspiring, generations of people to maybe do a bit of research about the sun on their own or about how the Earth orbits it. It definitely sounds like a great opportunity. Thanks, Dr. B, for coming on the podcast and sharing your thoughts about getting the word out about science. And I hope you enjoy Eclipse Day.
Dr. J, thank you so much for having me on Physics World. Yes, in 2017, we impacted 33,000 people in Central Ohio. We've set a bar of over 50,000. So to your point, I hope we can impact as many people around this wonderful eclipse that's coming our way. An absolute pleasure to talk with you, Dr. J.
If you aren't lucky enough to have a science center in your town, perhaps you might consider starting up your own. In 2022, I spoke to four members of Royal City Science, which was founded in 2020 to create a science center in the Canadian city of Guelph. You can listen to that episode of the podcast on the Physics World website or at your favorite podcast provider. Just look for the headline, Building a Science Center That Will Inspire Local Communities. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Dr. B, Frederick Bertley, for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Fred Isles. We'll be back again next week. But in the meantime, do check out the latest episode of the Physics World Stories podcast. Host Andrew Glester is in conversation with the composer Amanda Lee Falkenberg, whose Moon's Symphony takes listeners on an epic journey through the science and stories of the moons of the solar system. The podcast includes music from the symphony, and you can find it on the Physics World website or at your favorite podcast provider. Just look for the headline, An Orchestral Trip Through the Moons of Our Solar System.
Physics World.